are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. For this exciting episode, Josh and David are going to talk with two authors from Minneapolis-based publishing house Flexible Press, Diane Josefowitz and Karen Liborin. Josh will talk with Josefowitz in the first part of the hour to discuss her novel Ready, Set, Oh. Set against the upheavals of the 60s, it chronicles the struggles of a man who just lost his draft deferment, a young pregnant woman with fragile mental health, and a UFO chasing astronomer. In the last part of the hour, Dave talks with Boren about her novel Secret Waltz. Secret Waltz follows the coming-of-age journeys of three teens whose lives are turned upside down by the secrets they keep. In the end, Secret Waltz asks us, if you have a secret, do you still get to be good? All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
All right, Diane, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Welcome, everyone, to Right On Radio. Diane, if you are ready, you can begin with your first reading.
Thank you. Okay, so to begin, it's the summer of 1967. Our hero, Tino, is 21 years old, and he's just left medical school for reasons no one but he understands. The war in Vietnam is raging, and he is due to be drafted. His grandfather, his mother's father, has just died, and there is a big problem because the undertaker has forgotten the dead man's top hat. So Tino has been tasked to put the hat on the man's head at the funeral home, and so that's where this chapter begins. It's called The Watch. Tino knelt before the coffin, angling the hat one way and then another. Papa Tavio looked ready for a fight, his chin jutting up and out as if he were already at the pearly gates arguing his case with St. Peter. Or was it a different holy bureaucrat standing there checking off names in a book? Tino could never remember. Temping down his revulsion, he slipped a hand beneath the old man's head. It would be tricky to lift without making a pig's breakfast of the undertaker's work. A chemical whiff rose from the body, spiriting Tino back to St. Louis, where he'd spent the autumn hacking at a pickled cadaver. The professor had mocked Tino's inept dissections, lifting the ravaged tissues with a scalpel, a pencil point, a chopstick from his lunch. So what do you call this one, Batuta? Gastrocnemius? Popliteal? Mickey Mouse? All the structures looked the same and nothing like the illustrations in Gray's Anatomy. By the time Tino finished, he was half-pickled himself, and the stink no longer came off in the shower. When the class was finally over, he burned his lab clothes. The smoke smelled worse than formaldehyde, but unlike formaldehyde, it just blew away. Gravel crunched in the parking lot, the noise of his family arriving, early birds getting the day's sad worm. Tino nudged the hat again. If he failed at this task, his mother would give him hell. If he got it really wrong, say, by losing the hat, or allowing it to be crushed after carelessly setting it on the chair where his big cousin Aldo was about to take a load off, he would never hear the end of it. Still, he saw no clear path to his goal. Oh well, he thought, I tried. He set the hat on Papa Tavio's chest and tiptoed backward, as if his grandfather's body were a live grenade, as if the hat were its pin. I hate to disturb you. Tino started. While he'd been lost in his thoughts, Mr. Carcieri, the undertaker, had crept up on him. Easy does it. Mr. Carcieri rested his heavy hand on Tino's shoulder. Properly speaking, it should be on his head. He paused, considering. You know, I might have something in the office that could help with this. Mr. Carcieri left, his jacket vents flapping. On his way out, he passed Tino's mother, who, seeing Tino at the casket, blanched beneath her makeup. Tino felt the assessment in his tightening chest. He was screwing up as usual. She pointed to the door where coat hooks lined part of the wall. Tino hurried over, intending to catch the hat on a hook and be done with it. No such luck. The hook, missing a bracket screw, twisted in the wall and tipped the hat to the floor. Crouching to nab the fugitive, Tino discovered instead the missing bracket screw rolling from side to side on the carpet in a dime-sized puddle of light. His mother's black pumps crossed his field of vision, and then her face appeared, seemingly younger by a decade, the effect of being upside down. You'd think a boy your age could manage just one simple thing, his mother hissed. One simple thing. Tino heaved himself to his feet and back toward the lobby, muttering apologies he knew by heart. There were advantages to having a hardened one. A year ago, he would have resented his mother for all of it, from the absurd task that she had set him to the insult she had just lobbed his way. But his days of petty filial grievance were behind him. He was in a new country now, beyond her good opinion.
If you're just tuning in, that was Diane Josefowitz reading from her debut novel, Ready, Set, Oh. a story set against the upheaval of the 60s that chronicles the struggles of Tino, a man who's lost his draft deferment, his young pregnant girlfriend Primrose, with fragile mental health, and Lupo, a UFO-chasing astronomer. Joseph Woods' fiction and essays have appeared in Conjunctions, Fence, Dame, LA Review of Books, and elsewhere. As an historian, she has co-authored two histories of Egyptology, The Riddle of Rosetta and The Zodiac of Paris. She serves as the review editor of At Necessary Fiction and director of communications for Swing Left Rhode Island, a progressive political organization focused on electoral work, voter protection, and voting rights. Diane, welcome to Round Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the title of your book is really unique for me. Typically when I read a book and I come to have a conversation with the author about it, I use it as an anchor for discussing the interior of a book. But when I say the title in my head while I was reading it, it always sounds like I'm disappointed without trying to be. I was wondering, it makes me wonder like what the O is supposed to signify. Was that your intention at all when you came up with the title?
Now, the title is an interesting story because the title was not my first choice for a title. My first choice for the title was very different. My publisher actually came up with the title. It's the last few words of the book, and it is a statement of disappointment, but I think by the time you get to that point, you realize that it's also a statement of wisdom on some level, and it comes from it comes through the consciousness of a character we haven't talked about named Nora, who is a good friend of Primrose, one of our main characters, and also functions as a bit of the conscience of the novel.
This book begins with a quote from Natalia Ginsburg's book, Winter in the Abruzzi. I was wondering if you could talk about the significance of that piece and how it relates to the book. Is that something you're channeling the consciousness of the book from that little piece you have at the beginning?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Natalia Ginsburg. I've read a great deal of her work, and I came across it really for the first time as I was writing this book, the first draft, many years ago. And one of the things I like about Natalia Ginsburg is her clarity when it comes to life's disappointments. She's very good on that topic and how we make a life despite muddling through lots and lots of disappointments. And by making life, I mean making a really meaningful and rich life despite all the disappointments that are around us. And the essay, Winter in the Abruzzi, actually does create a beautiful picture of a very disappointing life and a disappointing landscape. And so I was very, very pleased to run across what I thought was kind of a précis of the characters in this book and their disappointing situations and the good things that they make out of them.
I loved how you open the book detailing the undertaker's handling of the body of Tino's grandfather, Tavio Brindisi, one of the main character's grandfather. And what I loved was that you treat his body as something that could still be a point of frustration for the people. I mean, when this is happening, when the undertaker's handling it, it brings up all these stories in him about coming over. And even at the wake, family members, they can't help make adjustments to his body and to his pin, or like you're talking about the top hat issue at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. His body almost becomes like a prop. And it's kind of funny how the characters respond to that. I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, to start with a character who's dead, I wasn't so sure to begin with that scene. What I liked about it was how undead the body was. What it gets at is this moment of, it's like a threshold moment, both for Tavio, who's passing over, and also for Tino, eventually it becomes a threshold moment as well. Tino is coming back from school, the person he was, the ambitious person with the very promising future ahead of him, that person is also just about dead. And there was something about that movement from a period of open horizons, of lots of life ahead of you, that is suddenly shut down for Tino and also obviously for Tavio. They seem to merge in that moment. They have a lot in common. So I wanted to start with the dead man. I had a second motivation there as well, because talking about Tavio made it possible for me to talk about Tino's whole world, which is a world of Italian immigrants in Providence, Rhode Island, in 1967, And they've been there perhaps 50 years. It's an immigrant community that is putting down some pretty serious roots. But at the same time, the memories of immigration are very present. And the friendships that are made in that very liminal state, those are also very present and alive in this world, which is passing away.
So I want to talk about that more with you. So, I mean, Tino's family, especially his mother, she is affectionate, but she's also very hard on him. And she's always expecting him to make the right decisions, the ones that she thinks that he should make for the family to respect their wishes. How much effort did it take for you to strike this balance with the characters close to Tino of wanting what's best for him? And because they do care about him, but in a way where it always feels like or at least he feels like they are holding him back. Was it hard for you to find that balance?
It wasn't too hard. Honestly, I really felt very clear about particularly Tino's parents and what they wanted for him and how their expectations created problems for him. I did want to bring that out. And I also wanted to bring out how much trouble those expectations also made when it came to the stuff that Tino did that involved other people, for instance, his girlfriend, who has parents of her own, who also have expectations. And it was interesting to put those sets of expectations in conversation with one another and then allow these two characters to find places of freedom together from those sets of expectations.
Does Tino's family... Does it bear any resemblance to your family or any families you had close contact with growing up?
I refuse to answer that on the grounds I might incriminate myself. But it's a world I know very well. I can say that.
Okay. Have you had family read your book and have they commented? Have they seen themselves at all in this book?
Yes and no. You know, people see different things in the book, and, you know, it's not really up to me to say, you know, to determine like how anyone reads the book or what they take from it. I feel like so far so good in terms of what people have found in the book. No one has, you know, cut me off or stopped talking to me yet. but yeah, you know, a long time ago, a writer by the name of Chris Offutt, he was talking to me about this exact problem. Like, what do you do with people who seem to resemble your characters or feel like they do? And he said something to me. He said, Diane, he said, the people you write about, they will never see themselves in your book because they don't see themselves, period.
That's actually really wow. That's actually profound.
I felt very safe after that.
Yeah. So Primrose, she's a girlfriend of the main of Tino, one of the main characters in this book, and it's mentioned very early in the book that she had been committed to a mental institution for a chemical imbalance in her brain, where she receives electrical shock therapy and other forms of experimental treatment. And I was wondering if you could talk about a little of your research into that for her character. How much did you do for her?
Quite a bit, actually, in terms of just finding out what would be a standard treatment for someone who maybe couldn't afford, you know, the top-of-the-line doctors or couldn't get to a cutting-edge clinic. You know, what would be done for a young woman in that situation? What could her family do? What would they be worried about? And also, what her doctors might do. And I'd looked into, particularly like in Rhode Island, what kinds of treatments were available for folks in 1967. And I discovered some pretty hair-raising things. I mean, the wet packs were a real treatment. Electroshock therapy was pretty standard, and it's not like it is today, which I understand is a gentler kind of electroshock. I don't know, but in those days, it was a pretty serious kind of intervention, and it could leave you with all kinds of side effects like lost memory and really bad headaches, stuff like that. So I did look into that that treatment and what its after effects might be, and it does have after effects on Primrose. She does lose bits and pieces of her memory and stuff like that.
And she's a really sharp and actually a really interesting character. I loved any kind of time we spent with her in the book. She's writing a book with her friend, The Book of Love, in order to tell, I'm going to quote this from the book, the primitive and vulnerable truth about sex and to demolish all pink and white laced edged illusions. And what I liked about this and how her and Nora are writing this, it's emblematic, I think, of everything their parents probably feared, and that they like sex and they want to talk about it and put it into a book. You could talk about where you got the idea for this. I mean, and also for the readers as well, what's fun in this book is you also have excerpts of their book in this novel. And it's always fun to read them.
Yeah, the idea for that, I think, just kind of grew up organically as I was developing these characters and their friendship. So I was thinking about their friendship and how they would communicate, one of the things, some of the things they might play with. And certainly they are both bookish characters. They both love to read. And they, of course, they would use their reading to inform their ideas about what sex is about, because neither one of them is having particularly a lot of sex. Primrose is having some sex with Tino. Nora's never had any sex at all, and so all she knows is what she's gotten from Primrose and from her reading. So I thought it would be interesting as I develop these characters to show what what they make of this this new experience. I mean, I'm in Primrose's case, or something that Nora is looking forward to, and the Book of Love was one way to surface those conversations and those thoughts and feelings. I mean, and certainly, growing up myself, I talked a lot with my friends. I still do, much more so than with my parents. This seemed perfectly natural to have a conversation about sex and make it be an ongoing one, in notes and notebooks.
Lupo Light is this character. He makes his first appearance in chapter 7, and we discover that he is studying astronomy, which it made me wonder, was this a subject that holds a special interest for you at all?
Yes, I'm very interested in astronomy. My PhD is in the history of science, believe it or not, many years ago, and the topic I focused on was in the history of 19th century astronomy and Earth sciences. And so I was very interested in that subject in my 20s. So I think some of that interest has carried over into the book. But I think the other piece that's informing Lupo is that as I was putting that first draft together, I discovered a cache of articles about UFO sightings in Rhode Island in the summer of 1967. There was a magazine called Probe that was published out of Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and it was an international magazine that collected reports of UFO sightings, and it was centered on the set of sightings that took place in 1967 in Rhode Island. And so I became very interested in why it would be why UFOs would suddenly seem to be present in Rhode Island at this incredibly fraught political and social time. And I began to think about how I would work those into the book. And of course, then Lupo kind of showed up as someone who would be the most unlikely UFO reporter of all in Rhode Island. And so that's the story of where Lupo came from.
In those journals, did you discover, was there any mention of dolphins making access with radio transmissions and using that to somehow reach the UFOs?
No.
Because I love that.
No. The dolphin is a gesture to a book from, I believe it was published in the 80s, that was also set in the 60s called Easy Travels to Other Planets. And it featured a dolphin and some research that was being done with a dolphin who was oddly sentient and almost human. This novel was by Ted Mooney, I believe. And the original title, actually, of Ready, Set, Oh! Was Easy Journeys to Other Planets. And it was a riff on Ted Mooney's novel from way back in the 80s that did have this dolphin at the center of it.
I'm going to look that up. I'm not familiar with that.
It's super fun. It's really fun. It'll blow your mind. It's a very funny novel.
You definitely handle telling the story of multiple characters, and you're very thoughtful about how you handle them. You give equal attention to, I think, their personal struggles. And I was wondering if you could talk about, did you plot out ahead of time of how you wanted to write each of these chapters and how you wanted to talk about these characters, or did this just naturally evolve over time?
Oh, I'm going to say a terrible thing. Okay, so I don't plot.
No, this is a great place to talk about terrible stuff. Go for it.
And I knew almost nothing about plot when I wrote this book. I've since, I hope, learned a little bit more. But I wrote this book in the first part of the 2000s, and I was in my MFA program at the time, and I had a teacher who said, you don't need to know anything about plot. He said, plot is just suspending information, and as long as you keep a clock ticking on the story, and that's Primrose's pregnancy, and as long as you keep suspending information, withholding some of the story from the reader, you will have enough of this thing called plot. And so I did the best I could with that that advice, and so I didn't plot it, but I did write a very fast first draft. So I had, within 6 or 8 months of having the first idea for the novel, I had finished the first draft. So I knew where it was going pretty quickly.
Throughout the book, Tino's repairing a boat that he's going to use, yeah. At least that's how we're led with the readers, to dodge getting drafted in the Vietnam War. And I was wondering, you talk about how common was it, people like Tino in the 60s, around this time, who tried to use this approach of taking a boat going across Lake Champlain into Canada.
I don't know. I don't think it was very common at all. I mean, I do think the boat is for Tino what the Book of Love is for Primrose. They're these symbolic objects that they use to kind of cast their way into a future, and they manipulate these objects. They play with them, think about them. In Tino's case, it's a boat, so he drives it around, and I won't ruin the ending of that story, but he does take it out, and so they do stuff with these objects, but I can't imagine too many people getting across Lake Champlain on a little tiny ramshackle leaky boat like Tino is planning to do.
I'm glad you said that, because the whole time I was reading, I kept seeing the less of the boat actually being a destination they're trying to get to, and just. The boat's more of a distraction, I think, from reality, and probably confront their issues. That's, to me, that's what it felt like reading his character.
I'm glad that came across, because these characters do have all kinds of problems with reality, for better and worse. And one of the things the book, I think, is deeply about is illusion, and how you can fall into illusions, get stuck in them, do well with that, or maybe sometimes not so well, but then reality kind of always comes and shows up. And it's either very reassuring, or it slaps you in the face, or both. And that all of these things happen to these characters.
And my last question for you: what's next for you, Diane? Do you have another novel?
Oh, yes. I have. I actually have a novella coming out from a press in North Carolina. It's called the press is called Regal House, and the novella has a French title. It's called L'Heure du Temps, which means basically the spirit of the age, and it is. It's not about the same characters, but it takes place in the same neighborhood. And it focuses on a 15-year-old girl who lives there in the 80s. She is just starting to come out of that stage of childhood where she's starting to realize the world exists around her. There are ways she can intervene in adult ways in the world. And just as she's coming to this awareness, one of her neighbors is shot. And as it turns out, her parents are involved in this murder. And the novella is about her discovery, just as she's sort of discovering herself as a new adult, herself as a sexual person. She's also discovering her parents as these murderers. And so so that's what the book is about. And that's coming in January 2024 from Regal House.
I've been talking with Diane Josefowitz about her debut novel, Ready, Set, O, from Flexible Press. Shortly, Dave Fedek talks with Karen Leiborn about her novel, Secret Waltz. But first, a few announcements and our literary calendar. Diane, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And now this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Dave Fedig, and I am here with Karen Leiborn. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Lovely to have you here. And let us tell us where you're calling us from.
Place I am in Bayview, Milwaukee. I'm on my book tour, and I'm going to read a little from the beginning of the book where there's a train, and I'm hearing a train in the background right here. There's one passing, actually.
Isn't that wonderful verisimilitude? I love that. Okay, so yes, we will start with your reading. So, but before you do that, of course, you're going to set us up. Maybe give us a general overview of Secret Waltz 2. Whatever you think we need to know about the story before we dive in, and then have
okay. The story takes place in 1966 in a fictional town called Buckhorn, Wisconsin, which is based on the area south of Milwaukee where I grew up. And it is a sort of dance of three voices. 17-year-old Sonia, who has received the first scholarship to the major university for a hard science that's ever been awarded to a girl. She's also pregnant. So 1966, that's a pretty dire situation for her.
Yeah.
Also Leo, who is 15. His father is a very well-known, famous, charismatic polka musician. He also is an aspiring musician, but to another kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
And Amelia, who we meet on her 15th birthday as the book opens. Amelia and Leo are friends. They're good friends, but they do not know Sonia at the opening of the book. But very quickly, their lives begin to intertwine in hopefully interesting ways.
Yes, they do. They certainly do. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for that description of Secret Waltz. And how about your reading?
Sure. Absolutely.
Do you want to set us up for where you're going to introduce?
I'm going to begin at the beginning of the book.
Oh, that's what you're
and
saying.
And we're going to begin with Sonia. She needs a full moon and a midnight train. At 3 minutes before midnight, with the tail feathers of winter still fluttering, Sonia Morrow balances on a single rail of the train tracks behind the Carlson's bean fields, listening for the Union Pacific's 1202 Cheyenne-Milwaukee line. She's got to be on the track at the first vibrations of the train or the ghost mother won't come. And who else can she turn to? She doesn't know the kind of people who would know the kind of people who would help her. She doesn't know anyone who will help her. She's trapped like a March hare, she thinks, not sure the phrase is right. No, she realizes, it's not right, mad as a March hare. Tonight, both are true. A gust of wind unbalances her, but determined not to fall, she throws her arms wide. According to the tale, if she falls now, it won't work. She's got to be on the track at the train's first vibration. Also, be barefoot and stay until the heat and smoke choke you. Stay until you're coughing, until your eyes burn and hot tears streak your cheeks. Stay until the arms of death pull you close. Only when it's life or death, when it's you or nothing, then and only then can you jump. If you miscalculate or chicken out, if you jump when you first spot the train's headlight, the ghost mother will steal your soul instead of your baby. And as you jump, you have to scream at a throat-scraping volume to be heard over the engine, mother, mother of the night, carry my child into light. Of course, many of the details are fictional trappings, there to entice you into doing something foolishly dangerous. But stay on the track. That's the key detail of the story, the part that stands to reason. Parsing the story from the science, she hypothesizes that the vibrations of the train will be mighty, teeth splitting, fetus jarring. Added to this are the trauma of waiting until the last moment, the effort of jumping, the violence of landing. So she has to be brave. She has to be steel, cold-eyed. She has to believe in the heat and the headlight and the vibrations of the train. She has to endure her teeth being knocked to sawdust until her very viscera loosen.
Wow. And I mean, wow. Beautiful writing, powerfully read by Karen Lee Boren from her new novel, Secret Waltz. Karen writes fiction and nonfiction. Her novel, Girls in Peril, was the premier publication for the Tin House New Voices series. Congratulations on that, Karen. And the Barnes & Noble Discover Selection. Her novel, Month of Fire, was a finalist for the New American Press Book Contest. And her story collection, Mother Tongue, was published by New Rivers Press in 2015. She has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and is the winner of the 2018 Wonder Editions Fiction Prize. Congrats on your marvelous career. And I mean that. That's wonderful.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, it really is a beautifully written book. I'm glad you read that. And frankly, I wanted you to keep reading. It's a great opening chapter. And it's really a powerful way to get introduced into these young people's lives, increasingly complex lives. So let's begin there if we can. Let's talk about the structure. You hinted at this when you told us about the overview, when you gave us an overview of the novel, but you chose to write each chapter is named. This one was named Sonia because it's about Sonia, from Sonia's point of view. And the next one is, well, at any rate, I've lost track of
Leo.
Leo, thank you. And so on and so forth. So why did you choose to go this route, Karen, in terms of telling your story, alternating chapters point of view?
It's a very clean pattern, as it were, in that it is a 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, which is similar to the polka. I just really wanted those three voices. They each have their own story. They each have their own story arc. Mm-hmm. They each have their own secrets to try not to tell, that they can't, secrets they can't tell, but also secrets that they want to discover. And I just really wanted a book that had a structure where you started with these somewhat divergent points and you sort of braided them in. And it is really a braided structure.
Yeah.
It's a very evenly braided structure throughout the book.
So we love to talk about the craft of writing on this show. And I don't know if you teach creative writing.
I do, yeah.
So did you come at this idea from the beginning? When did this idea come to you that you would write it in this way, 1-2-3, which is also a nice waltz beat? Was that from
the
start?
Thank you for the assist there. I'm just familiar with the waltz as I am the polka.
Given the title. I want to talk more about the title. It's perfect. But so did that come first, or the story as you saw it playing out? Or did this character speak to you, as they often do to authors?
Well, the thing that came first was this story of the ghost train that Amelia has in a very different kind of light. There is an actual kind of ghost train that I read about some kids on a track who were, you know, sort of playing with this idea of the ghost train, who actually got killed by the train. But the book actually really started out very differently. It met the characters who are 15 in this book, the four characters who are friends in their 30s after they had gone through the 60s, gone through the 70s, and now they were sort of coming up for air and trying to figure out who they were in the 80s. But it became clear that their backstories hadn't resolved enough and that I needed to go back and write that book first.
Yeah.
I really wanted to introduce Sonia's voice. And so it really was a bit of trial and error before I came up with the structure that I solidly landed on.
Was it a challenge for you to write in the voice of these young people?
Well, I wanted to try to get it right, which meant that I wanted to try to, I mean, I was born in 64, so 66 is still a bit of a stretch for me.
Right.
But I wanted the voice to be right for 1966.
Yep.
I wanted them to be 15 in 1966.
Yeah.
Which is very different from being, you know, 15 and 17 now.
Right.
But once I knew the characters, once I realized who they were as characters, and they started moving and living on the page, then the voices came pretty easily.
Did you have to do much research to set them back in time, or did what you just say sort of work for you? That is to say, once you figured out who they were and where they were, and it sounds like maybe you're familiar with Milwaukee, so you had some confidence about placing them somewhere, you were off to the races, or did you do a lot of reading about the 60s and young people?
Well, it is historically accurate in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I did an awful lot of reading about the history of both birth control, conception, the laws around that, about Roe v. Wade, about what women encountered at that time.
Right.
And then I also wanted to make sure the musical references were correct.
Yes.
So I was pretty, I might have played fast and loose with months,
yep,
but I certainly never played fast. There's nothing that's mentioned here that hasn't, in this book, that hasn't been released musically by 1966.
Yeah.
I was really very strict with myself about that.
Okay.
And then, you know, some of the other things, you know, it's you can be anachronistic really quickly, which is to put something in that doesn't belong in that time period.
Yes.
And I just, I hope I got it right.
Yes.
But I tried my very best not to put in anything that wasn't authentic to the period.
It feels really good to me. It really does. So the title Secret Waltz to me is really great. Secret, obviously, because the secrets are revealed in this book, and waltz being a dance. And these characters perform some sort of dance around each other over the course of time. So I think it's lovely. But music, as you suggested earlier, is a big part of these characters' lives, and it's a big theme, if you will, of the book. So you want to talk to us about, in a little more deeply, about each character's relationship to music and why it matters?
Well, Leo's relationship to music is really the strongest, and so is his father's. His father is a well-known locally polka musician. And I think what people don't realize about this form of ethnic music is that it was a financial force in the 50s and 60s. Huh. It was at least as financially lucrative as popular music, as country music. There's a recording studio that's in the book, Sila Records, that's based on an actual recording studio, Kuka Records, that was very much the way it appears in the book. It was in the middle of Wisconsin, you know, the middle of the mitten, as it were.
Yep.
Black musicians from Chicago, jazz musicians would come up, blues musicians, they would come, they would record there, they would press the record, give you the cover, you would drive away with the record. And so a lot of folks came to this recording studio to have records done that they didn't want their labels to have. Mm-hmm. It was a really strong force. So Stash, the Leo's father, being a local musician, it's a powerful thing in his life.
Yeah.
And so you have the concurrent at the 60s really is when you have these concurrent musical forms sort of reaching evenness. And then, of course, the polka ethnic music starts to diminish and rock and roll comes up. So that tension, I think, that Leo has with his father was a common tension of the time between the generations. And that's what I really wanted it to be, a vehicle to explore that tension between the generations that's beginning to occur in the 60s.
Yeah. And Leo, music, of course, is a connector, as you say or suggest, with between Leo and his father. That's some glue, if you will. But There's other tensions there, obviously.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we want to talk about that, but maybe we'll come back to Leo and his father. And how about the other two in music?
Well, they're a little bit less connected to it. That's not their primary focus. But they have other things that they're coping with, they're dealing with, other things, secrets and. For Amelia, she grows up with her aunts and they live over a bakery, and her aunts have raised her in this bakery, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I really wanted to represent was that time period when you lived and worked in the same place. You walked downstairs to go to work, your storefront, your tavern, your business was right there, and you were in it, and it was your livelihood, and anything that threatened it was really dangerous.
Yeah.
And many secrets were kept, I think, to preserve that.
Yeah.
And so that's much of what that milieu is, much of what Amelia has grown up around. And of course, Sonia wants to be a scientist. She wants to be a botanist. Her family doesn't understand this. They aren't scientists. And so she's a bit of a freak, not only in her family for being interested in science, but for wanting to do more with her life than she sees the women around her doing. She doesn't really have a model on which to base her own life.
Yeah. The passage you read introduces the idea of science and her relationship to science. There's a nice quote early on. I can't remember who says it. Your science only confirms what we old wives already know. And for me, when I'm reading that, old English major that I am, sets up a tension, a theme. How do we know what we know? Do we get everything we know from science? Where else can we get knowledge? And what's true? Universal topic, but comes through really strong early in your book, which I love. Speaking of Amelia and secrets, she's raised by her aunts, which is suggestive of one of the secrets. How much do you want to reveal about her and the secret that she comes to learn, or maybe nothing?
Well, I'd like to let the readers sure. come to that.
Yeah.
But she is given a secret on her 15th birthday by her aunts.
Yes.
And then told she has to keep it for the family. And so at that point, she has to make a choice between who is more important. And it's just at this time in your life, I think, when your friends are your family.
Right.
Especially for in 1966 in this area, very much where I grew up, I have five brothers and sisters. Most everyone I went to school with had multiple, you know, ours was a big family, but it wasn't the biggest by any means.
Right.
But none of these four friends have siblings. So they are each other's siblings. They are each other's families. And her aunts make her ask that question of who's my family?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's my real family?
Yeah.
And what are my loyalties to whom?
Yeah.
So suddenly she's given a secret. She's got to keep it from her friends. And that creates a different dynamic at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Remind our listeners that we are speaking with Karen Lee Boren about her new novel, Secret Waltz, out from Flexible Press, a press here in Minneapolis. And if we could, Karen, step back for just a moment from the novel in itself and talk about Flexible Press a little bit, if you don't mind. We like to feature our Minnesota publishers on Write on Radio.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we've dedicated an hour to two books from Flexible Press, and both wonderful books, novels. How did you come to Flexible Press? And tell us a little bit about them, your experience with them, if you don't mind.
It's been a terrific experience with Flexible Press. To give those out there who are writing, trying to submit a novel, I just submitted, there was an open call, and I submitted my book. And Bill liked it and contacted me. So Bill Burleson is the publisher at, along with his board and the other folks at Flexible Press. What's unique about Flexible Press and why I love it is because it's a mission-driven press, which means that every book is attached to a charity, a nonprofit, and every book that is that you buy has 10% of the sales go to that charity.
Yeah.
For my book, and every book has a different charity, ones that are appropriate to that book. And so the charity that's attached to my book is Planned Parenthood.
Yep.
And so it's also an author-involved press. And this is my first time working with an author-involved press where I'm being both given the opportunity and obligation to have a significant say in my book, both its production. I was able to have input on the cover.
Wow.
The original covers that were focus grouped were fine, but they weren't exactly what I thought would reflect the tone of the book.
Huh.
And so Bill went back and he had another round of covers made, and he focus grouped them again. And we came up with this one, which I think is just right for this book.
Yeah.
The editing, the promotion of it, the everything, you have a, it's a participatory press.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bill is just so energetic and so generous with his time and with his enthusiasm. It's been a fantastic opportunity to work with this press, and Minnesota should be very proud of Flexible Press. It's a significant thing to be an independent publisher right now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, beautifully told. And an author-centered press or author-involved press, I think it was.
Author-involved, for sure.
I love that. I love that term. I hadn't heard it before. Authors don't usually describe their relationships with their publishing house like that, so that's really wonderful to hear. Thank you for doing that, sharing that with us.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Planned Parenthood. You wrote a book. I don't know when you started it. It comes out right when we are all thinking and talking a lot about women's productive rights, or let's call them women's body rights. How do you want this novel to fit into this current and, of course, everlasting debate about women's bodies?
Well, I hope it's right at the center. It's an important issue for me. I began writing this book well over 7 years ago. It's not a surprise to me where we are today, but of course, I could never have imagined that we would be at this moment, at the moment that my book is coming out. So as I was delivering this book to my book launch, I heard on the radio that the Roe v. Wade decision had been overturned. I think if you read Sonia's story, you really get inside the complexities of this issue. So
yeah.
I am happy that my book, if it can do anything to help the conversation move in a productive direction, I'm very happy about that.
So you addressed my follow-up question, which is, what's the role of fiction in issues like this? You're an academic as well as a writer, and you teach. What do you tell students about this, the role of fiction, broadly speaking? And again, you've addressed this, but I think it's important just for us to think about that.
Well, I think stories matter. I think fiction is unique to all other mediums in that it can do something that they can't, which is that you can get closer to a character in fiction than you can to another human being in your actual life. So if you think about the person that you are closest to in the world, the person you love the best and know the best, you can still not crawl inside their heads and be inside their bodies and feel what they're feeling and see what they're seeing and see it and articulate it in the language that they would use. Film can't do that. It's got to come from the outside. Theater can't do that. It's got to come from the outside. Yes, you can have voiceovers, but you can't see it all through just one character's point of view and then move to another character. So I think the role of fiction for me is one of intimacy, of creating stories that dive deep into character. I'm a character-driven writer. I'm not ashamed of that. I love my characters.
Yeah, you certainly do. You shouldn't be. They're marvelous.
I'm glad you like them. It's so nice. I've been telling people that it's so nice that somebody else finally knows them. I feel like I've been hanging out with these characters for so long that I have nobody else in the world knows them. And finally, people are starting to get to know them.
Well, they seem real.
They're real to me, so I hope that comes across on the page, absolutely.
Yeah, and with a topic like reproductive rights, abortion, whatever the case might be, and pick your social theme, they have to be in novels. Social themes have to be in novels, or they're just not real novels, I guess. Oh, well, they can be, but to do this without being pedantic, to talk us through a complex issue like this and keep us riveted to the story and for readers to then learn something ultimately about themselves, that's tricky. That's difficult to do, I would imagine, for a writer. You don't want to preach to us because we don't want to be preached to, right? Even if we agree with you. How do you balance that?
Well, it's not propaganda, you know? Right. I mean, I really wanted to think about it in a complex way and to present characters who think about it in a complex way.
Yeah.
Go through phases. They don't come in with their ideas fully formed any more than we have our ideas fully formed. But it's also about storytelling and giving them other things to create their realities as well. You know, there's a reason that Shakespeare has the grave diggers and they have bad puns and they lighten the tension at various times. This story needs to have a flow, and it needs to have moments of tension and release and tension and release throughout the book if it's going to play to the end.
Yes.
All the way to the end.
So do you want to talk to us about the big tension? The big thing that happens that sort of spirals the narrative to the end? Or do we want to keep that broadly secret also? I'm asking you to tell them.
I know. Well, one of the things about the book is really, I really did want it to be about secrets as well.
Yeah.
And what the effect of secrets is. So if there's a broad arc in the book,
okay,
it is the arc of secrets.
Right.
And what the implication of keeping a secret is, and what the ramifications of keeping secrets are. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the book, so as I said, each character has a secret that yep. they have to keep. Mm-hmm. And each character has a secret that they have to find out. And by the end of the book, the reader has a secret that they can't tell.
Yeah.
They can't tell the characters. Yeah. And they know something
Beautiful.
That the characters don't know. Yeah. And so I really wanted that to be sort of the overriding arc of the book, is this idea of secrets.
Well said, well described. It's a beautiful structure. Writers listening, there are many of you. You should be envious of it. It's a great idea. Karen, we are at the end of our time here. We've been speaking with Karen Lee Boren about her new novel, Secret Waltz, just out. Please look it up, folks. And her last name is B-O-R-E-N. You have a wonderful website. That's not easy to do either. Before we let you go, what's up next? You got something else in the works?
Yes, I do. I'm working on a collection of short fiction right now. Also, you know, I do know what happens to these characters later. So it's possible if people are interested enough that I might write that up.
Brilliant.
But yeah, mostly I'm working on this collection of short fiction and really having just a great time doing experimental things in a shorter form. I love the short fiction form. You can get your head all the way around it.
Yep.
Which in a way that you can't with a novel.
Sure.
And so you can play a little more and you can experiment. I experiment more in short fiction, so I'm having a ball doing that.
Oh, that's awesome. We look forward to that. Don't forget about us when that comes out.
Absolutely.
We have been speaking once again with Karen Lee Boren about her new novel, Secret Waltz. Thank you much, Karen. This was a delight.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good luck on your tour.
Thank you.
Bye now. And now this.